From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu's next two-year budget increases general fund spending while also cutting taxes. Yesterday, he outlined plans for more spending per student, a paid family leave program that does not involve an income tax, and a boost to the state's rainy day fund. In this hour, we're going to take a close look at the state's next two-year spending plan, plus an update on COVID-19 in New Hampshire, a look at legislation aimed at police reform, and I'll chat with a New Hampshire resident who will soon appear on the television show Top Chef. A lot's been cooking this week, and we'd love to hear from you, especially if you have questions about the governor's spending priorities. Call us now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can use Facebook or tweet us at NHPR Exchange or email us. That's a great way to reach us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And with me now to discuss the governor's budget address is Phil Sletten, senior policy analyst at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Phil, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me, Peter. It's great to be here.
Let's start with first impressions. What stood out to you about Governor Sununu's budget address yesterday?
Right. So the budget's obviously a really important document. Every 2 years, the state has to pass a new state operating plan. And in the governor's budget address, he recognized that this is the budget that is coming out of the COVID-19 crisis. This next two-year period is going to be really critical for what the economic recovery looks like. And the governor identified, for example, mental health supports, and that's likely going to be something that there's quite a bit of need coming out of this, the current COVID-19 crisis. We don't really know exactly what the economy is going to look like. The governor seems to be projecting expecting a relatively robust economic recovery. He noted that in New Hampshire, the economy has recovered to a certain extent. Obviously, there are still quite a few people who are struggling. More than one in four adults in New Hampshire in the latest round of U.S. Census Bureau surveys of the state, so this is in early and mid-January, indicated that it was somewhat or very difficult for them to pay for usual household expenses. So this next two-year period is going to be really critical for that economic recovery, and there are still quite a few people that have to recover. The governor's budget lays out some areas where there would be additional support, and as you noted, there are some increases in funding that would help with that transition. However, we don't have all the information yet, but we have most of it, and it appears that there are some places where there are more supports, and some places where it looks like there may be changes in support.
You said we have some of the information, but not all of it. What do we have, and what are we still waiting for?
Right, so we have what is the primary operating budget bill as proposed by the governor. So that the document totaled about 1,300 pages, so we have lots of information. However, there's still about what may be 100 or 200, and has been up to that in the past, pages of really policy changes. And the governor might be less than 100 pages, might be more, but the policy frameworks that are set up around some of these programs that the governor's proposing, we don't have that yet. We haven't been able to take a look at that yet. That should be coming soon, but that will inform a lot of the policy proposals other than just the sort of expenditure line changes that the governor is proposing as well. But in his budget address, he did outline a fair bit for us.
And one of the things he did outline, or at least mention, was lower taxes for just about everyone. How does he propose doing that? And is it really as good as he makes it sound?
Yeah, so there are three tax rate reductions that the governor has proposed. One is a proposal to reduce the business enterprise tax from 0.6% to 0.55%. And the state has two primary business taxes. One is the business profits tax and one is the business enterprise tax. And it's actually rather interesting that the governor disconnected them. Over the last 6 years, we've seen business tax rate reductions at the state level. And the business profits tax and business enterprise tax have typically seen their rates reduced at the same time. The governor recognized that, as he put it, the business enterprise tax affects small businesses a little bit more than the business profits tax. Of course, both taxes have the potential to impact businesses of any size, but the business enterprise tax base is broader. because the business enterprise tax isn't levied on businesses, is levied on businesses whether they're making a profit or not. It's based on compensation, interests, and dividends paid or accrued in summary form. So that that compensation based means that if you're paying someone wages and you're a business and you meet the filing thresholds, which the governor does propose raising, then you may be liable for business enterprise tax unless you have some other credit. The business profits tax is really largely levied against large businesses are primary part of the tax base there. They still are a very important part of the business enterprise tax base, but it looks a little different. The base is much broader because it's not dependent on business profits, whereas the business profits tax, really large corporations drive a lot of that tax revenue base. Mm-hmm. So the business enterprise tax being lowered and the thresholds raised, the governor is proposing, as well as reducing the meals and rentals tax rate from 9% to 8.5%, and also phasing out the interest and dividends tax over a five-year period. It's unclear exactly how he's going to do that. Again, there's some policy, some questions around what the policy looks like that will be in some of those additional details the governor provides. But that interest and dividends tax phase out doesn't appear to impact his revenue projections that much for this budget cycle. However, the interest and dividends tax is a really significant source of revenue. It brought in about $126 million in the last completed state fiscal year. So if that were to go away entirely, that would eventually have a pretty significant budget impact.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you on your thoughts on the governor's budget address. What do you make of the governor's next two-year spending plan? If you have questions or comments, call us now. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Phil Sletten, we get this email from Anna, who was writing with a question about how it's possible to cut taxes without cutting spending. She writes, I heard nothing about what spending Governor Sununu plans to cut. I bet it's going to hurt poor people, schools, and towns. Phil Sletten, what do you make of Anna's comments?
Right. So one of the things that the governor is projecting, and again, as part of my sort of initial reaction was seeing his revenue projections, which are within the range of what state agencies projected. The state agencies in the administration that collect revenue provided revenue projections to the House Ways and Means Committee back in late January. The governor's revenue projections are within the range of that, but generally it's a much more optimistic revenue a revenue picture than we thought we would have when we were talking about what the revenue shortfalls might look like in this budget back in June and July of last year, for example, of 2020. Looking forward then, it looked like it was going to be a much worse picture in terms of state revenue. The governor's budget provides an updated set of projections that are more optimistic. It's unclear exactly, based on the information we have now, how much the governor projects revenues would drop from a business enterprise tax rate reduction. It looks like there is some drop in his budget projections, but it's not clear exactly how much is due to that rate reduction. The meals and rentals tax is still recovering. A lot of restaurants have not been serving as many meals, and hotels haven't been renting as many rooms as prior to the pandemic. So it's a little hard to parse out exactly what those impacts would be. And again, the interest and dividends tax, the phase out over a five-year period really depends on what that phase out looks like. But that means that the impacts on this budget, it's still a little bit unclear exactly what those impacts are. But the budget does grow. Both the governor's budget increased, if you compare this budget proposal to the last one as passed, it's a 3.1% increase. Federal funds are a 7.7% increase if you compare the 2 years to the we're currently in the current state budget as passed to the governor's proposal. There was a 5.4% increase in general funds, which is where a lot of those tax revenue dollars go. But there's a decrease in highway funds, a decrease in turnpike funds, and a decrease in the education trust funds. So looking sort of broadly at how the money is spent in the governor's proposal across six broad categories of state spending, the governor's budget would increase health and social services, increase justice and public protection, and increase resource protection and development, but it would decrease spending in general government, in education, and in transportation. So we do see some adjustments in what the governor proposes that are spending reductions that are likely needed if the tax rate reductions were to go into effect.
So, Phil, you said there was a reduction in the amount contributed to the state's education trust fund?
Yes. So the adequate education aid, as proposed by the governor, and the adequate education aid is the education grants on a per pupil basis that are provided to local public schools to fund education for students. Those adequate education grants, as they're called, there's one budget line for them, and that budget line did reduce by $100 million relative to what is in the current state budget, what is in the current state budget as it was passed. Now, that $100 million reduction, that is not the only way in which local public schools receive education aid from the state. The governor appeared to hold constant in his proposal. Transportation aid also appeared to hold constant. Certain special education aid as well. That's a really provides targeted relief for special education. But it is this budget likely does reflect, and again, we don't have all the details yet, but in the current state budget, the one that was passed back in 2019, there was a significant amount of new aid directed at school districts that had more students who were eligible for free and reduced price school lunches, so a higher concentration of those students, and for more school districts that had a lower amount of taxable property wealth per student. The governor in those budget discussions around the current state budget back in 2019, the governor identified those as one-time funds. So it appears, based on what we know now, it appears that the governor did not continue those targeted funds to to school districts with more low-income students and to ones with more limited property tax bases. But the drop is a little bit larger than that, so there's sort of more to explore. The governor did, in aggregate, boost school building aid or propose boosting school building aid. It's less through the sort of regular formula and more through the public school infrastructure fund, which is directed a little bit differently. It's informed by a commission and directed by the governor with approval from the Legislative Fiscal Committee and the Executive Council. I will say, too, the governor did propose, given that the pandemic has complicated a lot of the calculations around where are free and reduced price school meal students, how many are enrolled, the governor did propose allowing schools the flexibility to really look at whichever enrollment levels are greater. We know that need has increased, but some enrollment in aggregate statewide has decreased. So this the federal waivers that have permitted more students to receive free and reduced price school meals has the potential to affect the school funding formula in New Hampshire and maybe undercount some of those the number of students that are low income. Which we can expect has gone up during the pandemic. The governor provided flexibility so that schools can use either their pandemic or pre-pandemic era, whichever was greater figures for that to receive that funding. So it's a complicated picture when it comes to education funding. There are a lot of moving parts. In aggregate, education funding, education overall appears to have dropped, as well as the education trust fund in the governor's proposal. That's relative to the current budget as passed, which included a fair number of funds that the governor identified as one time, but would still be a reduction in aggregate were this proposal to become the next budget.
Mm-hmm. The governor had, before his budget address and during his budget address, said that the state government should be downshifting cash, not costs, to cities and towns. This might come as welcome news to people who are worried about their property taxes rising so much that it'll put a financial strain on them. What can you tell us about how the governor plans to transmit or downshift cash to communities so that maybe property taxes won't have to go up as much?
Right. There's the property taxes that are on the school district side. There are property taxes that are city and town property taxes, and there are also property taxes that are county property taxes. And these all sort of combine to your individual property tax bill for those of you that are homeowners. The municipal aid side, the aid that goes to cities and towns, there is the meals and rentals tax, which is actually the second largest tax revenue source the state has that it actually collects money from. The meals and rentals tax is, according to statute, supposed to contribute 40% of its revenue to cities and towns and distributed on a per capita basis. That 40% figure hasn't been reached recently, has been suspended over time. So the most recent time that I've done the calculation prior to the pandemic, it was about 20 or 21% of meals and rentals tax revenue went to cities and towns. Now, there is a catch-up formula, so there's the policymakers in the state have noted this shortfall and built a formula to get back to that 40% level over time. However, that catch-up formula has been suspended at various points over the last decade, so the amount of revenue coming from the meals and rentals tax to city and towns has been held constant as opposed to allowed to increase. The governor appears to be proposing that it be allowed to increase for each year of his state budget proposal, mm-hmm. Which would total up to, and it depends on how meals and rentals tax revenues come in, but it would total up to a $15 million increase over the course of the biennium.
So Phil Slatton, I'm sorry to interrupt, but would that be enough, the changes to the rooms and meals tax alone, to assuage some of the fears and make the math work so that property taxes don't rise in a way that really hurt people?
Well, so it would certainly contribute, right? There would certainly be more money for cities and towns there. However, there's relative to the current budget, there's a little bit of a different calculation, right? So the not only did we see education aid, potentially drop depending on exactly what the formulas are for distributing it and how those formulas may be changed, but also in the current state budget, there was passed $40 million in, again, identified as one-time aid to cities and towns. So that $40 million does not appear to be repeated in the governor's proposed budget. It looks like this $15 million increase, which is perhaps more likely to be a permanent increase because it's an increase in the formula as opposed to one-time aid, that increase, obviously a $40 million decrease is smaller than a $15 million increase. It also appears that on the county side, counties are responsible for a certain portion of Medicaid payments in New Hampshire. That is a sort of a shared responsibility with the town, with the state, pardon me, to fund individuals who are in nursing homes and on Medicaid. And it looks as though the governor proposes that the counties would pay an additional $47.6 million in costs relative to the current budget. So that's a county property tax, not the town property tax, but it's something that could also affect the property tax bills of individuals in the state.
I want to ask you a few questions about the coronavirus pandemic generally. First, we know that the coronavirus pandemic has disproportionately impacted people with lower incomes and people of color. Does this proposed budget address that? And if so, how?
Yeah, so in terms of the disproportionate impacts on lower income folks and to a certain extent, people of racial and ethnic minority groups in the state, really looking at where the investments are, I think it will be important to look at where the investments are in both low-income communities. So the education funding certainly interacts with that, especially if we're thinking about racial and ethnic minority groups in the state, then about close to half of both the population identifying as Hispanic and the population in New Hampshire identifying as Black or African-American, close to half of both of those populations live in Manchester and Nashua. So looking at, for example, school funding in Nashua and school funding in Manchester and how aid is directed to those communities will be really important for understanding what's affecting, especially the students, the children in those communities, and students or children on the whole in New Hampshire are more racially and ethnically diverse than the population as a whole in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to look at where are some of the supports for people who might have lost work and are more impacted by this crisis. So that's mental health supports are included in there. Unfortunately, substance misuse is also perhaps a consideration if someone's lost a job and is grappling with the impacts of the COVID-19 crisis, the lack of other social and economic support. And the governor does address or does provide resources or propose resources in his budget, both in mental health and substance misuse areas. He also mentioned paid family medical leave as well. We don't know the details of his plan yet, but he has proposed plans like that in the past that may provide support as well, depending on, again, what the framework of the plan looks like.
There are federal programs targeted at some of the things you just mentioned. To what extent is this budget depending on larger than usual infusions of federal aid to make sure that the state can make ends meet and help people in the way that they need to be helped during the pandemic?
Yeah, so there are some really important federal programs that provide assistance, sometimes through the state government and sometimes directly to individuals as well. Key ones that work through the state budget include the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, also known as the Food Stamps Program in New Hampshire. Those federal dollars do flow through the state budget, but they are entirely federal dollars. One area in particular, I mentioned Medicaid. Medicaid is a state-federal fiscal partnership where the federal government and the state government both contribute dollars to provide health coverage for people with low and moderate incomes and limited means. That enrollment in Medicaid since before the pandemic, so since the end of February of last year to the end of January this year, enrollment in Medicaid has gone up about 20%. And it appears that this budget does keep a Medicaid reimbursement rate increase that was passed, took effect in January of this year. That Medicaid rate increase means that there's more money available for providers. And those providers then who are reimbursed for those services are able to, or maybe better able to, offer wages that allow them to hire more workers. There was a workforce shortage before the pandemic in the healthcare sector, and in particularly healthcare providers that rely more on Medicaid funding. Having lower Medicaid reimbursement rates means that they have less revenue coming in, and they are less likely to be able to hire someone because they may find higher wages somewhere else. They are less likely to be able to hire someone to provide those services for people with limited means and low incomes. So Medicaid's a really important program any budget cycle. It's going to be particularly important this one, and the governor appears to have kept the 3.1% rate increase. That was the most recent increase in Medicaid provider rates in his budget proposal.
Governor Sununu proposed merging the New Hampshire college and university systems. How do you think that'll impact the state's budget?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The community college system and the university system of New Hampshire are right now separate entities. The governor does propose merging them, but they are funded through what are essentially block grants of general funds in the current budget. So in the governor's proposal, he combines those block grants of general funds, but it appears to be about the same amount of funding. It looks like it's about a $2 million drop in the second year if you were to compare those aggregate amounts. So the budget impacts are really limited to the amount that the state decides to provide, if you will, when it comes to what the block grant of general funds looks like. The governor appears to envision some savings, but it really what we see in the budget is the amount the governor contributes. And it looks like, again, relatively level funding compared to what we see the university system and the community college system funded at now. I'll note that the university system still hasn't gotten back to the levels that it was funded at in terms of general fund block grant funding that we saw prior to the Great Recession. So back in the earlier in the 2000s, prior to the 2007 to 2009 recession. So this budget appears to envision a little bit of cost savings, but again, it's about the same amount of money allocated from the state budget. There may be cost savings in other places in the community college system and the university system as a result of the combination, but we don't necessarily see that reflected in these numbers.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Karen in Laconia. Karen, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yesterday, I listened to the governor's address, and he kept insisting that he was increasing funding for schools, but your analysis today makes it sound as though funding's going to go down, so I'm a little confused about that.
Well, let's take an opportunity to clear that up. Thank you, Karen. What do you think, Phil Sletten?
Yeah, so I think the critical piece here is what your baseline is, right? What you're comparing it to. The governor and the legislature in 2019 agreed on a state budget that included what the governor called explicitly one-time funds for local public education. Again, this is education aid directed at directed at more communities that have higher concentrations of low-income students and communities that are relatively property poor. If you consider those one time and take out that $62.5 million in one-time aid, then some of that reduction that we see is minimized, right? Some of that becomes smaller. If you consider that, what's in the current budget and compare it to what the governor proposes, and that's what I'm doing with these figures, is just looking at what's the current budget as passed and what has the governor proposed comparing across those two-year periods, then we do appear to see an aggregate reduction. Again, there may be other appropriations that are in the parts of the budget that still have yet to be released or that were not released yesterday alongside the governor's budget proposal. That could change the picture. But right now, it looks like there is an aggregate decrease. I'm sure we'll learn more in the coming days.
And Phil, what changes are you expecting to see to this budget, if any? You mentioned there's more to come.
Yeah, so I think that there will probably be some consideration around what's going to happen with mental health supports as we know more about what the shape of the pandemic looks like in the coming months. For example, there's a big increase in funding to New Hampshire Hospital. That's the sort of thing where we may see as social distancing becomes less critical and we know more about what some of the mental health care needs are in the state, what happens to funding levels on the mental health side. I think that'll be really important going forward. What happens to state revenues? The legislature will have more information about state revenues than the governor had available because they will be working on the state budget later in the process. So they'll have a little bit more information, then they can use that to make some changes. What happens with federal funding? It could be that the federal government provides an influx of funds that the state can use and deploy to either offset budget shortfalls or to boost services reflecting the increased needs as we're sort of climbing out of a recession as opposed to at the end of an economic recovery like we were in 2019. So I think there's a lot of moving parts as we go forward, probably more than in a typical budget. But it's important to remember that this budget is at an inflection point. This next two-year period is going to be really critical for supporting the economic recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. And that this COVID-19 crisis has disproportionately impacted people with low incomes, people with limited means, people who are already in vulnerable population groups in a lot of circumstances. So I think that the next two-year period, because that's so critical and because there are so many moving parts, there are a lot of variables that will affect this budget process going forward.
Well, Phil Sletten, Senior Policy Analyst at the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll speak with NHPR's Todd Bookman about the state's response to COVID-19 and the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine in New Hampshire. The state is anticipating more doses in the coming weeks, including through a special arrangement with Walgreens. What questions do you have about vaccinations in New Hampshire? Email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or for the quickest response, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. At a press conference this week, state officials said several COVID-19 metrics are trending in the right direction. Hospitalizations, new known infections, and deaths are all dropping, which is a trend we're seeing nationally as well. And while more people are getting COVID-19 vaccines, some problems with the appointment system linger. With me now to assess where we are now in the fight against COVID-19 is NHPR's Todd Bookman. Todd, thank you very much for being here.
No problem. Good morning, Peter.
And listeners, if you have questions about the state's response to COVID-19, give us a call now. Phone number 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. Todd Bookman, overall, what does the data say about how New Hampshire is doing in containing the coronavirus, including deaths, hospitalizations, new cases? How's the state doing?
Sure. Well, the state is certainly doing better than it was. We saw numbers in December and January really spike likely due to holiday gatherings and continued reluctance by some to follow public health guidelines. We are now down to around 400 positive cases each day. That's good. We were you know, closer to 1,000 a month ago. The number of hospitalized people right now is down to 140. That is still definitely above the levels from the first wave of the coronavirus back in the spring. But the number reached, you know, closer to 330 in early January. So 140 is certainly more manageable for our frontline healthcare workers. We did see deaths soar again during December and January. More than 500 residents died in those 2 months alone. But the number of fatalities in the past few weeks has begun to trend in the right direction. So overall, the numbers are coming down in the most important categories.
And starting this week, the state said that anyone who received their first dose of the coronavirus vaccine should automatically receive an appointment card for their second shot. Todd, how's that process been going?
Well, I think like all new programs, there were definitely some bumps. We heard from people who got their shots at the state-run clinics in Exeter and Lebanon, who said that earlier this week, the clinic staff seemed unaware of this new program. Some people did not leave with appointment cards. Other people left with appointment cards that had a date, but not an actual time. But this seems to be the minority of people. Overall, what we're hearing is that essentially this new system is up and running and is functioning well. So if you do go this week or in the future and get your first shot at a state-run vaccination clinic, you should leave with a second appointment written down on a card for you. And this whole system was meant to sort of clear up you know, what's been taking place over the last few weeks where there was real sort of chaos with the VAMS system. This is the online system for registering for first and second vaccinations. And people weren't automatically being given that second appointment. They had to go log back in. And so it was creating a lot of chaos and a lot of very long appointment windows. So right now, this new system does seem to be working a lot better, and people are getting their second appointments in a timely manner.
And if someone has received their first shot and their second shot is scheduled to be further away than the CDC recommended 42 days apart, how do they go about rescheduling it so that it occurs within the appropriate timeline?
Well, our understanding is that you need to follow the system that you use to schedule your first appointment. So if you used 211, which is the state's hotline, you need to call the 211 hotline. If you created an account through the state system and then through VAMS and scheduled your first appointment that way, you need to go back in and reschedule your second shot through VAMS. And this it takes an act of faith, because you have to cancel your second shot before you can see new appointments. So a lot of people we know were reluctant to do that because we had heard stories of people canceling their second shot only to find appointments had been pushed out even further. But the state says it has now updated the system. There are enough second shot appointments for folks who've already received their first dose to be in this recommended time frame. So the state is encouraging people to cancel that second shot if you are weeks and weeks beyond the CDC recommendation. See what's in VAMS, and if you still are having trouble finding, you know, a shot in that appropriate timeline, you can always call 211 for assistance.
I see. So when the governor says that we are done with VAMS, we're really just phasing out VAMS. Some people still might need to interact with it to get their second dose.
Correct. And if you haven't registered yet and you are in phase 1B, you still need to go through VAMS. That is the system that is in place. You can create your account at vaccines.nh.gov, and then you will get a link to this second federal system, the VAMS system. So everybody in 1B still needs to go through this process or call 211. But the good news is that nobody needs to now schedule their second shot through VAMS. That's going to be done automatically.
All right. Well, listeners, if you have questions or comments about this vaccine rollout system or anything else related to the state's response to COVID-19, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Worth noting that VA hospitals in our region are hosting COVID-19 vaccine clinics this weekend. The VA in White River Junction, Vermont, is hosting a clinic for veterans over the age of 65 tomorrow, that's Saturday, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then the VA in Manchester is hosting a similar clinic on Sunday from 8:30 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Veterans who are enrolled in VA healthcare can get their COVID-19 vaccines at these clinics on a first-come, first-served basis. Clinics will close early if all doses are administered, and veterans who are not enrolled in VA healthcare can start the process now before getting to either of these VA hospitals. Second doses will also be administered at the same location exactly 4 weeks from your first shot. So VA clinics hosted this weekend for vaccines on a first-come, first-served basis. Todd Bookman, the state, announced a new vaccination partnership with some Walgreens locations in the state. Can you tell us a little bit about how that will work and who is eligible?
Sure. So I think we'll expect to see more partnerships like this, but the first one is with Walgreens. They are going to begin administering about 3,400 COVID vaccines each week. These doses that will come straight from the federal government. This is not part of the state's sort of weekly allotment. And as of right now, they will be given to folks who are eligible in phase 1B. But you can't make appointments directly with Walgreens. So do not go to your Walgreens. Do not call your local Walgreens. You still need to go through the VAMS system or call 211 to make your appointment. What the state is doing is, rather than directing people directly to Walgreens when they first sign up, essentially you pick another location and then the state is going to redirect people to Walgreens. They're going to start by taking those folks who have appointments the furthest out. So we're talking about people who are now scheduled into April for their first shot. The state is going to call one by one all of those folks and offer them spots at local Walgreens on a much earlier time frame. So that's the system for getting those Walgreens shots. It's essentially out of the public's hand. You will be assigned by the state.
Mm-hmm. Todd, we got this question from Jamie by email, who asks, how safe will it be to see my mother once she is vaccinated, even though my family and I are not? I heard it is still likely to carry the virus and thus spread it even after one has been vaccinated. I haven't seen my mother in well over a year now, and it breaks my heart, especially because she's missed so much time with her 3-year-old grandchildren. That's the question from Jamie. Todd, have state officials addressed the efficacy of the vaccine and transmissibility of the virus after someone is vaccinated?
Yeah, we've heard a lot from Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state epidemiologist for New Hampshire. And unfortunately, the message we're getting right now from state public health officials like Dr. Chan, as well as the CDC, is that it is still sort of not safe to go back to normal after you've received your vaccine, even the second dose. And the reason is the vaccine is 94-95% effective, but it's not 100% effective. And so until we sort of get enough of the population vaccinated to reach, you know, this term called herd immunity, until we reach those levels and until there's more research done on the potential for people who have been vaccinated to still carry the coronavirus in some form, you know, what we're hearing from public health officials is that we can't go right back to normal just because we've received vaccines. So that's the message we're hearing right now. There's certainly more science on this beyond my knowledge. So I would encourage Jamie to look it up for herself. But this is the message we're hearing.
There's so much to learn about this. We couldn't possibly cram it all into this segment, but point taken, Todd. Thank you very much. So what about Group 1B? About how long is the state saying it's going to take to vaccinate everyone in 1B who wants to be vaccinated? And when might it start vaccinating people in Group 2A?
So we're booking appointments in the state for phase 1B right into April at this point. We've heard of some locations even into early May. And so until the supply of vaccine increases, that's just the timeline that the state has to follow. You know, New Hampshire was receiving about 17,500 doses each week for a few weeks in a row. That has kicked up slightly. We're now getting, I think, closer to 22,000 doses each week. But remember, phase 1B has something like 300,000-350,000 eligible residents. And so that's just, you know, the math says this is going to still take a long time to complete 1B. If the supply increases, that will be kicked up. Certainly the Walgreens initiative and programs like that will help. But it doesn't look like 2A is going to start, you know, certainly before April at this point, I think is a fair guess. It's just a guess at this point, but there's still a ways to go.
Mm-hmm. And how many people have been vaccinated in New Hampshire so far?
The numbers that are on the CDC's website, I checked this morning, Peter, and it is about 130,000 people have received their first doses. 53,000 now have received their full second doses. So that's out of a population of 1.35 million, something like that. So we're now approaching, you know, about 10% of the population that's had its first dose. Certainly an important number to follow moving forward.
We get this question from Kristen. I do want to acknowledge it, Todd. She's writing, my 85-year-old dad has an appointment April 10th for his first vaccination. Can he get an earlier appointment at Walgreens, and how would he do that? He made his appointment by calling 211. Todd, I think you were saying you got to wait for the state to call you with respect to the Walgreens appointments, right?
Yeah, that's correct. For Kristen, at this point, there's just no way for individuals to take, you know, initiative to bump up those vaccinations. These appointments are scheduled well out into April now, and at this point, there's no way for people to sort of do their best to, you know, to bump that up earlier. The Walgreens partnership will require a phone call from the state. The state is working from the back of the list forward, and so folks who are out that far may get a very good news phone call. But as of right now, there's no way to sort of speed up that process, however frustrating that may be, Kristen.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that answer. Let's talk to Brad, who's calling in from Nashua. Brad, thank you very much. Yep. What's on your mind?
Yep. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to mention there's one additional step that I don't think has been pointed out when someone's scheduled to go in for their initial vaccine. And that is if you register through VAMS, you're going to get an email within 24 hours prior to that vaccine. And the email is going to say, go online and fill in this form. It's like a survey of some sort that you have to do. Now, I'm scheduled to get my vaccine. My friend told me about this. And when you show up and you haven't done it, it creates all kinds of delay. So people need to know, check your email like within 12 hours before you go there, and you'll find this online link. Is that what you're finding, Todd?
Brad, you're exactly right. Yes. So we've been told that anywhere between 12 and 24 hours before your first appointment, you will get a pre-vaccine survey. I believe it poses questions again about allergic reactions and health issues. Certainly an important, you know, medical step. Folks are encouraged to do that online. They should get notified with an email. We have heard, though, that you can fill the form out on site at one of the state-run vaccination clinics. But I think everybody agrees it'd probably be better to do it on the internet, in advance of that shot. But yes, Brad, you're correct.
We get this email, Todd, from Nell, who says it isn't necessary to cancel your scheduled appointment through VAMS before you schedule a new time. I called 211. I was on hold 1 hour, but after that, the man gave me a new appointment on the spot. And then I went to VAMS and canceled my prior appointment. Very easy to do. So, Todd, we've been hearing stories, too, that, you know, sometimes there's a hold for 211, but 211 is a very helpful number to call when in doubt.
That's true. It sounds like Nell knows perhaps more about this process than I do, which is totally reasonable. 211 is the state's best resource right now for folks looking to speak with a human to get their questions answered. We have heard of long hold times, but I think that is sporadic and based on the time of day that you call. But yeah, the best resource when you have questions is certainly 211.
Well, NHPR's Todd Bookman, thank you very much for sharing your insights. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
And just a reminder, we have more information about the coronavirus pandemic and answers to your questions at the website nhpr.org. Coming up after a break, we're going to take a look at some legislative efforts at police reform. Lawmakers are discussing proposals on restrictions on use of deadly force, tear gas, and rubber bullets at protests, to name a few. What's your take on this? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. It's also a good place to send lingering coronavirus questions. We're always going to be reporting on that. So again, exchange at nhpr.org is the email. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. New Hampshire lawmakers are continuing work on proposed bills designed to change the nature of policing in New Hampshire. For more on their progress, we turn to NHPR's Mary McIntyre. Mary, thank you for being here.
Hi, Peter. Good morning.
And listeners, if you have questions about any of these bills, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Mary, why is the House currently hearing so many proposed bills about police reform?
Sure. Well, you know, some of these bills have come up before in previous legislative sessions and are just making their way back around again. But others are new proposals that stem from the LEAC Commission's recommendations. If you remember, Peter, Governor Sununu created that Commission on Police Accountability and Transparency last year. It was made up of several law enforcement officials and community leaders from organizations like the NAACP and the ACLU. A co-founder of a local Black Lives Matter chapter also served on the commission. And that group made a long list of recommendations for police reform in New Hampshire. And several of these new bills in the legislature are aimed at putting those into law.
Okay. And can you explain some of these proposed bills that have been discussed in the House so far? What would they do if enacted?
Right. So there are two competing bills in the Senate right now on public disclosure of police records. One of those bills would make those records more transparent. The other would actually make them more difficult to access. You know, increasing transparency and accountability in policing is a big goal of people advocating for reform. There's also a Senate omnibus bill that would address multiple LEAC Commission recommendations at once. That includes establishing funding for body cameras and for requiring police agencies to collect demographic data, including race, for all traffic stops. And in the House, there's also a bill on body and dash cams that would make them mandatory for police departments. And then there are also some proposals made by lawmakers who are working with local Black Lives Matter chapters. One of those bills would have limited the use of rubber bullets and tear gas, but that was actually voted down by the House Committee on Criminal Justice earlier this week.
Mm-hmm. And how would you summarize some of the main points of contention in these proposed bills? So what are people disagreeing about?
Sure. So, you know, there's bipartisan support for police reform in general, but, you know, there is disagreement usually along party lines about how that should be done. But to be frank, you know, a lot of these are still, it's pretty early on, a lot of these are still in committee right now. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. And how have lawmakers been responding to them?
Yeah, so like I said, still early in the session, mm-hmm. a lot of these bills were just introduced in committees within the last week or so. You know, some of these House bills have actually already been voted down in the House Committee of Criminal Justice and Public Safety. That includes a bill that would have banned no-knock warrants. And like I said earlier, they also voted down that bill that would have limited the use of rubber bullets and tear gas by police. But the Senate omnibus bill, it has good bipartisan support. Lawmakers are still working out the details, but it looks like it might have a good chance of making it to the full Senate for a vote.
All right. Well, NHPR's Mary McIntyre, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on these. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
And here are some of the stories that NHPR has been following this week. The New Hampshire Senate passed a right-to-work bill yesterday. The bill would prohibit collective bargaining agreements between unions and employers that require employees to contribute union dues. Instead, unions could only collect contributions from those who volunteered to join. This is the latest effort in New Hampshire to join 28 other states in adopting right-to-work legislation. An effort early in Governor Sununu's first term in 2017 fell flat after disagreement in the House. Also, the University of New Hampshire is suspending in-person classes due to a rise in the number of positive COVID-19 cases. Nearly 200 UNH students are currently isolating with active cases. Under new rules, gatherings will be limited to 6 or fewer people. Students can no longer have visits from people living in other dorms or off campus. UNH's Law School and Manchester campus are not currently changing their operations. And a male New Hampshire state senator has apologized after calling a female colleague a vulgar name. Senator John Reagan of Deerfield used the vulgarity Wednesday after fellow Republican Senator Sharon Carson called a 10-minute recess for their committee so she could take a doctor's call about her hospitalized daughter. Reagan later apologized for his, quote, recorded outburst and told the Associated Press in an email that it was, quote, an open mic Zoom goof. Republican Senate President Chuck Morris is calling the comment inappropriate and disappointing. Remember, listeners, if you have questions or comments about anything you hear in the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Change of pace now. Chris Vio is the chef and owner of Green Leaf and Culture, both located in Milford, New Hampshire. He grew up in Randolph, Massachusetts, attended culinary school at Johnson & Wales, and he lives in Milford. He's been instrumental in starting 4 restaurants in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and his latest claim to fame, he'll be featured on Top Chef, a show where chefs compete against each other and have their work judged by established industry professionals. Chris Viau is on the line with me now. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
What an exciting opportunity to be on Top Chef. What was the audition process like?
It's truly an experience for sure, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. It was definitely a long process, and leading up to that, one of my old chefs who I worked for in Boston, Adrienne, who was on season 16, she was the one that kind of threw my hat in the ring and kind of gave me the opportunity and said, Chris, you should really go for this. I mean, you have a great personality. Your talent is second to none, and I believe that you would be able to kind of show that you rank amongst the best in the country. So I took her up on that, and a few months back, she sent in my name to casting, and casting reached out to me. And from there, it was pretty much just going through the entirety of the process and getting to know the casting directors, sending in interviews, and just really letting the team know about me, who I am, what I stand for, what kind of chef I am, and let them decide from there.
Yeah, and as part of the interview process or audition process for this, did they make you cook something on the spot? Did you have to submit a recipe and show them how you did it? What was that like? Was that a part of it?
There were many things leading into the audition process, and just really having myself express to them the talent that I do possess, and wanting to make sure that the contestants that they are choosing are ranked amongst the best in the nation, and just going through all the background information and seeing where our talents do lie and knowing that we will be the correct choices for the show.
Mm-hmm. So how did you feel at the beginning of the competition?
It was a nerve-wracking experience, definitely. And just leading up to the whole thing, just the nerves and the anxiety were building. Just knowing for so many years I've been watching Top Chef, and to finally have the opportunity to be competing on the show is just an unreal experience for sure. And I can't even put into words the emotions that were running through. I knew from hearing from past contestants how stressful everything was leading into it, and I wanted to try to just make sure that I was going in clear-minded and put my best foot forward.
So as someone who had watched the show before actually being on it, what surprised you? What did you experience participating in the show that you said, wow, watching this, that never would have occurred to me?
You can definitely feel the angst from the competitors as they're going through running around the kitchen, and I definitely felt that tenfold. The clock is a real clock. It's not staged. That time is the time. If you have 30 minutes, it's a real 30 minutes, and you have to create an elegant dish that will hopefully advance you in the competition.
Wow. And have you competed in cooking competitions before?
Yes, I have. I've actually competed in the Joint Chef competition, which is a young chef competition that young chefs under the age of 21 compete around the U.S. For the title of the best young chef. And that was probably many years ago. I've competed twice in that one. I've competed on Steel Chef. So cooking competitions isn't anything new to me, but being on such a large platform, this was definitely a change.
Yeah, and I know you can't talk about the outcome of your appearance on the show, but what did you hope you could bring to the competition?
I was really just going through all my emotions and learning, kind of leaning back onto my training, my education, and really wanting to just express my culinary talents and learn a little bit more about my food itself. I know I have Culture and Greenleaf, which are both doing really well, and those two establishments have their own identity, but the journey for me going on Top Chef was to find my culinary identity and who I am as a chef.
Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, happening during the coronavirus pandemic. So what kind of safety protocols were in place to make sure that you and the other competitors and the judges and everybody there were safe?
The crew did a tremendous job in ensuring that we were all taking the right safety measures to ensure safety. We were going through and doing testing periodically throughout the course of filming, required to wear masks when we weren't filming, socially distanced. The kitchen was arranged in a much different way than it was in previous seasons, as it was a much larger area, and the tables were spaced accordingly. There was less interaction with the judges face-to-face, and it was just a couple of those things that we kind of had to take into play for this round of filming, just knowing that we are in the midst of a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure there are people out there who are excited to see you on the show. When can people see you on Top Chef?
People can see me on Top Chef on April 1st is the premiere date.
April 1st. Okay. Marking your calendars. Chris Vio, chef and owner of Greenleaf and Culture in Milford, New Hampshire, soon to appear on the show Top Chef. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And that is it for the roundup. But remember, you can find links to all the stories that we discussed today at nhpr.org. And worth repeating, too, something we mentioned earlier, that a couple of VA clinics happening this weekend for people who want to get COVID-19 vaccines on a first-come, first-served basis. One's happening tomorrow for veterans who are enrolled in VA care over the age of 65. Tomorrow at the VA in White River Junction. That's Saturday tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then there's another one at the VA in Manchester. First come, first serve for veterans over the age of 65 from 8:30 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. If you're not enrolled in VA healthcare, you can start the process now before getting there. And second doses for people who show up will be administered at the same location exactly 4 weeks later. We're always taking your questions or comments, by the way, on COVID-19 vaccines and the rollout process here in New Hampshire. You can send those to exchange at nhpr.org or check out our frequently asked questions page at nhpr.org/vaccines. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Jane Vaughn. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips produced the show, and senior producer for The Exchange is Ellen Grimm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.